The next case on the court's calendar this morning is Seaberg versus Cesarez, case file A240894. Could the attorneys please take their seats? We'll give you a moment to become situated. Each side will have 15 minutes for oral argument this morning. Appellant will have an additional 5 minutes of rebuttal time. We are ready for arguments from appellant's counsel. Please state your name for the record before beginning your argument. You can approach the podium to do so.
May it please the court, my name is Charles Klass, C-L-A-S. And I represent the appellant in this matter. We have raised one issue in our brief that is before the court today, and that's whether or not the district court erred in granting the harassment restraining order in this case. We have raised this argument on two different grounds. First, that it was an error to find that the conduct was intrusive or unwanted pursuant to the HRO statute. And then second, that this intrusive or unwanted conduct would have had a substantial adverse effect on the privacy of the respondent in this case. Starting with the first issue, the whole reason why we are here and why an HRO was granted to begin with is this idea of a cease and desist which was sent and then which was broken in the respondent's eyes a year after it was sent. The idea of a cease and desist being an ironclad document that could prohibit contact between two parties for essentially eternity, so long as the one party that sent it doesn't revoke it, does not fit with how humans interact with one another, and certainly is not the type of conduct that is to be prohibited by HRO statutes.
Can I ask you a question? Do you think that district courts, in all cases, need to have a cease and desist letter or a piece of evidence that's very close to the time of the conduct at issue in order to come to the conclusion that the conduct is unwanted?
Not in every case, Your Honor, but in this case, I think that the specific relationship between the parties makes this cease and desist even more relevant or even more of an issue.
Well, what about the fact that there are 7 text messages at issue, all, I think most of which occur very late at night or in the very early morning hours, none of which the petitioning party for the HRO, who's the respondent here, appears to have responded to. So why isn't that at least circumstantial evidence from which the district court could just determine without an abuse of discretion was evidence that the communications were unwanted?
The timing issue with respect to these 7 text messages that the district court did focus on, in our opinion, is irrelevant, or certainly is not circumstantial evidence that these would have been unwanted. I think in today's day and age, we send text messages at all times, just because someone's...
But if someone texts you at midnight, and you are living in the same time zone as that person, it would seem to me that common sense would indicate that there was some urgency. And if the person that receives that message doesn't respond, and then doesn't respond 7 times, why isn't that circumstantial evidence that the contact was unwanted?
And we're setting aside the cease and desist in this case and just focusing on these text messages. In a case like this where you have a mother and a daughter that previously had a relationship that no longer have a relationship, and the mother in this case is working to build back that relationship, a lack of response shouldn't be enough to give a district court proof that they are unwanted.
You just hit on something important, right? Because relationship history is something that the district court consider and evaluating whether there's an abuse of discretion, we can consider, right? So you just pointed out that they had a relationship and then no longer had a relationship. So still setting aside the cease and desist letter, they have this relationship history where they've had a falling out. There's seven text messages that go unanswered. At least after the first six, why isn't that circumstantial evidence when you add in the context? And you can see what I'm getting at, because then eventually we can add in the cease and desist letter as part of the totality of these circumstances. And I'm having a hard time seeing how this is an abuse of discretion when you put all of that together. Tell me why that's wrong.
I have to go back again to the context of this relationship. I really think that is important and a distinguishing factor here, that it is a mother and a daughter. And I know that the relationship had ended or at least was really not existent at the time of these text messages. But it's different from maybe other common HRO scenarios like two neighbors, maybe a romantic partnership that ended at some point where you wouldn't expect there to be any attempt or any need for these two parties to have contact again. When it's a mother and a daughter or some other close familial relationship, that does color our analysis differently, because I don't think it's reasonable to expect the mother, my client in this situation, to say, well, I just have to accept that my daughter hasn't responded six times over a small period, and therefore these are 100% unwanted pursuant to an HRO statute.
Well, you say small period, but the first one was in November and the last were New Year's Day, so it's over a couple months.
I guess I was thinking small period in terms of the context of their life, but yes, about a two-month period, a little over 2 months.
I like to go back to this issue of we've got 11:07 p.m., 12:08 a.m., 11:57 p.m., midnight, 12:03 a.m., 12:34 a.m. You don't think the time of those texts factors into the analysis in terms of what's reasonable or how it would be perceived?
I don't, Your Honor. I truly don't.
And when you get a text, unless your phone's silenced, you still get pinged. Do we not sort of respect that you don't call someone's house before 8 a.m. during dinner time or after 10 p.m.? Or you're saying, oh, all bets are off in this day and age, you call somebody 24 hours a day. Is that the way reasonable people behave?
Unfortunately, we don't have testimony or evidence on exactly what the original petitioner was receiving, whether or not she actually viewed these at the time she received them or viewed them. My memory tells me no, we don't have that. But there is a difference in society, I believe, in terms of texting versus calling, as the court just brought up. Calling is one thing. Calling has a little more urgency to it. Texting, and again, we don't have evidence here as to whether or not there was a ping, whether or not she woke up and had to deal with this in the moment or saw them when she woke up the next day. So we're somewhat assuming here, or basing it off of societal standards at this point.
Okay, well, let's take that out. But now respondent's in a position where she knows her mom is texting her in the middle of the night frequently. Is it unreasonable for her to have angst about that and to be worried, well, now this is going to drift into a phone call or now she's going to show up at my house? I mean,
so Your
we
Honor,
can assume, you know, some reasonable reaction to receiving multiple texts in the middle of the night from someone who you have directed in writing not to contact you, even if it is your mother.
And Your Honor, I believe that question really goes to the second prong of this. What effect did it or could it have on the daughter in this case? And
well, she's testified that it was unnerving. I mean, why shouldn't we take that at face value?
I think we can take that at face value. I think then don't
you lose if we do?
The harassment restraining order statute is not meant to prohibit unnerving conduct. People have disagreements.
But I mean, your second point was, did these texts or communications have an adverse effect on the respondent? She testified they were unnerving. That would suggest to me that that was an adverse effect. I mean, the problem I have, I agree with you, the mother-daughter relationship, you know, having a daughter and still being married to the daughter's mother, is a unique relationship that sometimes has its ups and downs. But, you know, for whatever reasons, the respondent decided she did not want to have any more contact with your client, and she followed it up with a letter. You know, none of these communications were like, hey, dad's dying, or, you know, I'm in the hospital, in which case I would say, you know, that's a little different. Most of them just seemed to be a request to reinitiate contact, which for her own reasons the respondent did not want. So why would we reverse the district court's decision if it is abuse of discretion, counsel?
I think the court just hit upon what is important to us in our argument in this, which is ultimately, what is the point of harassment restraining orders within this state and within our society? Truly, what kind of conduct should we be concerned about here? And as the court just recited those facts, those are fully accurate. We don't disagree with that recitation. That is exactly what happened here. What we're left with, though, is a situation where families are allowed to litigate their own interpersonal relationships through cease and desist letters and ultimately a harassment restraining order. And if we believe that one person says, do not contact me, and the person contacts them, whether it's 2 weeks or a year after that initial, hey, don't contact me statement was made, and that's always going to be grounds for an HRO, that is over-policing of human relationships and how ultimately humans should be left to deal with their problems.
It seems like you're straddling the line between a kind of constitutional challenge or you know, a blanket challenge to the HRO statute and an argument that, well, this particular conduct wasn't objectively unreasonable. The first I'm not very concerned about because we've already rejected that, and it, as a matter of law, the HRO statute is constitutional. But the second part I think might be, in my view, your better argument. I have a couple concerns about it that I'd like you to address, and the first is, it seems to me like you're ignoring part of the HRO statute, which allows the district court to find harassment if it is based on repeated incidents of intrusive or unwanted acts, words, or gestures that are intended to have a substantial adverse effect, not just that have a substantial adverse effect. And here we have evidence in the record that your client admitted in her testimony that at least some of the texts that she sent were sent out of her being upset and offended and her being frustrated, not out of her trying to reach out to rekindle a relationship, but because she was, and this is in particular the chosen one's text message. You know, and we have to look at the relationship history like we talked about earlier, the bipolar text message that was sent. So, you know, this isn't a situation when we think about the objectively unreasonable standard where your client was just reaching out saying, hey, I ran into your kids the other day. I really miss you. I know you told me that we can't talk anymore. I'd like to reestablish our relationship, and then left it at that. It was a series of 7 text messages sent close to midnight or after midnight over a period of months, and ending with a message in which she said she sent out of frustration. And so we know what the intent was, or at least circumstantially there's strong evidence of it. Tell me why it's objectively unreasonable, or why the district court abused its discretion in finding that this is not objectively unreasonable to determine this is harassment.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree with the classification of my client testifying that that last text message was sent out of frustration automatically means that she intended to harass with that. I think there is a distinction there of you can be frustrated, maybe send something that you might even regret, but not actually have an intent to harass. And I think that is what happened.
The question was, why would you send that? And eventually the answer was, I was a little upset and offended that she chooses to have conversations with them, being her sisters-in-law, and she wouldn't have conversations with her family. I was frustrated at that. That is the reason why she sent it, is because she was offended, upset, and frustrated. So I don't know, it doesn't seem to me to be a big inference, you know, to go from that to she's sending this to harass her daughter.
I would still disagree. I believe that harassment restraining orders do allow for a pool of content where people are allowed to act out, people are allowed to be rude, people are allowed to say not nice things. People are allowed to do that with having bad motives, but it still doesn't amount to true harassment. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
Counsel, I'd like you to address on rebuttal, just building on what you just said. I agree, and the case law is clear. We do have to put up with certain things we'd rather not put up with. But here we have had an evidentiary hearing at which both appellant and respondent testified. So the district court, sitting as finder of fact, was able to observe them, their demeanor, their interaction, their body language, and had to make a call, you know, do I believe what's happened here crosses the line? Why aren't we deferring to that decision of the fact finder who was able to observe the parties, their interaction, and have to make some tough decisions about whether this conduct crossed the line? So if you could address that on rebuttal, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, counsel for respondent, please state your name before beginning your argument.
Good morning. Michael Kane, C-A-I-N, counsel for the respondent in this case and the petitioner for the harassment restraining order, Ms. Brianne Seiberg. Appellate argues today that the record that was before the court here doesn't support a finding that appellant's actions constitute harassment and because of one, that it wasn't either intrusive or unwanted, or two, that if it was intrusive or unwanted, that it was not objectively having a substantial impulse or intended to have a substantial adverse effect on respondent's privacy. The determination of what constitutes an adequate factual basis for harassment restraining order is left to the discretion of the district courts. Here, the district court properly found that appellant crossed that line, as we had just discussed. First, I want to address appellant's argument that the statute is not intended to deal with familial conflict, and I feel that that is contrary to the plain language of the statute, which states that harassment may occur regardless of the relationship between the actor and the intended target. And so while it, as you've sort of pointed out, there is circumstantial evidence that is helpful for the court in determining this, the fact that they're mother-daughter really is not anything beyond that circumstantial evidence. Second, I want to take a look at appellate.
What is intrusive or harassing about sending a text that says your kids are pretty amazing and Happy New Year?
So if you look at that on its face, you might think that that is a common and reasonable text to send. But when we're taking a look at the context that was provided in testimony and in my client's petition and the relationship of the parties being tumultuous, I don't think there is any facts that are disputed that this relationship was tumultuous, that it ended. We take a look at a Happy New Year text that is sent and saying that your kids are amazing in the context of my client just went through a divorce. She testified that she was concerned that her mother was siding with the father of the children so that she could broker time with the children when they didn't have a relationship at that time. And it's intrusive to her privacy because your family, the people that you want to associate, the people that, whether blood or not, you bring into your circle, is a very personal and private thing. It is something that you should have the autonomy to understand what your privacy is and to communicate those boundaries when you feel that that privacy has been breached.
But to be fair, that makes sense in the context of perhaps the cease and desist letter being sent very close to the time of that text message. But, you know, the cease and desist letter is sent October 4th, 2022. There's no contact. In November 2020, or at least in the record, November 2023, that's when your kids are pretty amazing and Happy New Year. Well, yeah, your kids are pretty amazing in November. And there's not a response from your client saying, hey, I meant what I said over a year ago when I sent this. I don't want contact with you. Where we could then look at Happy New Year, you know, just a month later as, okay, she's very clearly established that she doesn't want any contact with her mom. This is approaching the level of harassment. And then when it continues, you know, see that the district court didn't abuse its discretion here in deciding that's harassment. But, I mean, looking at it from that lens, you know, I don't know whether or not I agree that the district court didn't abuse its discretion in deciding these kinds of texts without more, without phone calls, without going to her place of business, without coming to her home, rises to the level of objectively unreasonable conduct that would amount to harassment.
I would tend to disagree with that. I would say that just looking at, and I believe that the court's questions to appellant were right on point, that taking into the context of when these occurred, the context of the messages surrounding the additional things that were testified at trial, the tumultuous relationship, the using kind of a backdoor through the father of the children to have the children be visited, and that she didn't, as pointed out over here, she didn't simply say, hey, I saw your children. I'm sorry about what happened. I would like to rekindle. It was, your kids are amazing. And that, in the context of it all, was, as my client described it, a jab to her. To say that, I'm now seeing your kids, even though we don't have a relationship, and now I'm trying to resume contact and kind of put that in your face.
So the district court decided that, at least the written words of the district court's order are that the contact has and would have a substantial adverse effect on the privacy of the plaintiff. How did the text messages have an adverse effect on your client's privacy?
So when you are receiving a text message from someone that you have communicated that you already don't want to have contact with, whether that's a cease and desist letter, whether that's something more informal, then you get contact from that person, you have a time of apprehension when you receive that. You have, and my client testified, that she became anxious afterwards, after the fact even. That goes into her personal time, her private time, where she is still thinking about the text message, what could occur from this, what might happen. And I don't think it needs to rise to the level of some sort of intervening incident, such as showing up directly at the person's thing. It says that two incidences of words. The statute says words here. And the case law says, you know, once we get to this first incident and then a second incident, we've got repeated incidents. And that repeated incidence of words under the plain letter of the statute can constitute harassment. The case law also shows that it's not, you don't receive a cease and desist letter and it's a carte blanche automatic that you're going to obtain a harassment restraining order. Actually, when she received that, there was no legal significance. It didn't have any legal significance until there was conduct that crossed that line. And so again, it was clear that, very clear in the letter, that any kind of contact, whether it's a text message, whether it's showing up, whether it's a social media message, she would feel harassed by that. And so the court found that appellant was on notice and knew that there would be some adverse effect. And so that's where the intent shows. On the other side of this, It did have an adverse impact on my client. She testified that she felt anxious, that she felt.
What if, so these texts kind of in succession came about a year after or the cease and desist letter. What if the cease and desist letter, what if these texts, these exact same texts, came 20 years later in the exact same order they came now?
I think that we would be talking about a different factual circumstance, and that would play into. I think that the period of time that elapses could be relevant. I think that. Why is a year different than 20 years? Because there is 19 years difference there. There is significant time that passes. I think that that my client would still have a case, but there would be a solid argument on the other side that 20 years would be a reasonable amount of time to let things air out before you reach contact again. But a year after reasoning, a year after the circumstantial evidence where there was no communication, my client did not respond to these communications. And as, you know, to a kind of counter argument, appellant didn't reach out to our office to say, I received this cease and desist letter. I'm hoping to rekindle the relationship. How do we go about doing that? Instead, chose to, in the middle of the night.
So is it the frequency, is it the number of texts that is crucial as opposed to what the texts say?
I don't think that there is a bright line rule. I think that
what if these seven texts, I think Judge Eats said, what if each text said simply, I love you?
If it said, I love you.
Exact same time frame at midnight, but each text simply just said, I love you.
I think that, again, that's another set of circumstances that's not before the court, but to entertain
why are these texts so much worse than simply saying, I love you?
It's colored by the testimony of each party, the context of their relationship, the context of the children.
I understand then, okay, so your kids are pretty amazing is a jab because she saw the kids and mom was on ex-spouse's side, but how is Happy New Year? You're welcome to come visit. I work weekends now, but I'm off on the 15th. How are those a jab? Other than that it's a text and there was a letter that said no texts.
I think it is a jab because the way she testified that their relationship had deteriorated to the point where that wouldn't be seen as a genuine genuine statement on its face, as you would read just seeing the plain reading of the text messages, and that the context surrounding it certainly colors why that would give apprehension to my client. Additionally, just the fact of receiving text messages, and going back to the I love you example that you had brought, just the fact of having to deal with and have the apprehension of this, is this going to lead to something more?
Whether your client could have blocked these text messages?
The record does address whether she could block these text messages. It says that she did not make an attempt to block the text messages, but I think that goes directly to your point where she left the line of open communication and where the context of the relationship comes in. If she had said, died, then that is different.
But I mean, if she didn't block them, I mean, if your client had blocked them, we wouldn't be here because, you know, no matter what she says, it's blocking. So what are we to make of that? Did want to have some relationship at some point with Mr. Klass's client?
I think that's not necessarily that as an inference that she wanted some relationship. It's an inference that there is an understanding that there is a significant relationship here, even if it is estranged. And that line of communication for something like I'm in the hospital or your dad died today or your cousin's funeral's coming up might be a reasonable text message to send.
Nothing in the harassment statute that requires someone to change their phone number or move residences or change employment if they receive harassment in any particular form, right?
That's correct. And then if we're looking at Cush v. Madison, it states that a district court can make a finding of harassment or intended to have a substantial adverse inference even if the intended victim shows resilience to the harasser's ongoing conduct. And that would be, in, for lack of a better term, showing the resilience, allowing those communications to come through because something urgent might happen.
The fact that you can block it, block text messages, and the mode of this communication has to play into the district court's analysis of whether it was objectively unreasonable, right? I mean, it's just the nature of what the conduct was. We can't discount that. I mean, that's why it's part of the evidentiary record. Presumably it was relevant, so that's why it was discussed.
I absolutely agree that it was relevant. I think that, again, the testimony and the circumstantial evidence and the inferences that were drawn and the credibility determinations that were made really color these text messages that on their face could look like reasonable text messages. Let's see here. And then I think I want to address the Witchell versus Witchell case, which the appellant relies on, where this court vacated a HRO based on statements in a visitation book that were read more in context. Rather than, we have stated there isn't a magic word that you can say. There isn't, doesn't need to be inflammatory. It doesn't need to be derogatory. And then looking at the statements themselves, in that case, they found that it didn't rise to the level here. But I think that that shows that there isn't a bright line rule. We're looking at a case by case and individual facts here, and that this case is more comparable to Cush v. Madison, where the additional findings about other incidents, particularly the text message that said, I'll see you on the other side, bipolar, had color to the context of why this was unwanted communication and why it was unreasonable to send these messages after being on notice that they were unwanted. The present case shows that respondent had said that appellant is an abusive parent, that the parties had an estranged relationship, the appellant's prior text message saying, see you on the other side, all of these, the cease and desist letter, both parties' descriptions of the contentious family dynamics, and finally, the determination that the appellant's claim that she did not intend to harass lacked credibility, while they found that my client was credible, that she had apprehension, that she had an adverse impact to her privacy was made. With that, I rest your honor.
Thank you.
Going back to this issue as to whether or not the district court abused discretion, and if they did, how exactly did that happen in this case? I think we have to look at two different parts of the district court's decision. The first is that, setting aside credibility determinations and exactly how they viewed the parties, they made their decision on relatively not in controversy facts. The texts were unwanted because of the cease and desist. I think that's clear from the district court's finding that that is what they based their decision on. The court has already heard my argument as to the effect of this cease and desist and the effect of it a year later. The district court got it wrong in that specific instance. That wasn't even necessarily them exercising discretion that only they were in a special position to view, like viewing a witness in person. This is a factual finding that is not really in controversy as to when it was sent and then what was done with it afterwards. And that is something that this court can look at and say that it was wrong. That was a wrong decision. That was not something that they were in a special position to view. We can look at this based on other case law and the arguments made here as something that the district court erred on. The second part of this does lean more towards their special position as the district court judge and the person that oversaw this hearing. I think of special concern to me was the finding against my client, not only that they weren't credible, and I'm not sure even how the lack of credibility on my client's behalf actually would factor into the district court's decision here,
Well, is what she meant as to the message about your kids are pretty amazing. I mean, I think that some of these messages, clearly, I think the district court accepted as earnest. You know, you're welcome to visit, 112 through 115. I work weekends now, but I'm off on the 15th. Can we please work things out? I just want to be a family. I don't think anybody, and including the district court, didn't make a credibility determination on those. But your kids are pretty amazing. The district court made a credibility determination that she didn't mean that. Your client didn't mean that. She meant, I got to see your kids without your permission, and I was with your ex-husband. And that's something that we can't mess with. We're stuck with that on appeal. No matter what you might argue about it, we have to defer to it.
And, Your Honor, this goes back to the last topic that we were discussing when I was last up here, which is, let's say, and like the court just said, we have to assume that the district court was right, at least in that determination as to how they viewed my client. Let's say that's fully accurate. How does that still lead to a finding that my client intended to harass? I assume that's what the district court meant, is that they weren't acting in good faith when they sent these, and that this finding on behalf of my client is evidence that my client intended to harass when she sent these. And I just disagree there. That's where the error is. It's not even necessarily in the credibility determination or the factual determination that they made with respect to my client. It's, let's accept that as true. Let's accept that my client didn't act in a way that we would like her to act, that she acted out of spite or anger, or maybe even that she acted to get her daughter going in this situation. That is okay, or at the very least, it is okay under the harassment restraining order statute. And that really is an argument that I will continue to go back to, is that there has to be some amount of leniency for people to act not necessarily how we would want them to act socially, but still not rising to the level of needing a harassment restraining order to prohibit their conduct. And that's ultimately why the court can find that the district court erred, because you don't even need to disturb the credibility determinations or the determinations that they made with respect to the witnesses, because we can accept that as true and still tell ourselves that ultimately this isn't conduct that would have had an effect on the safety, security, or privacy of the respondent in this case. Ultimately, I ask the court to reverse the district court decisions for the reasons argued above. Thank you.
Case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days. We appreciate your argument.